Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, it's Monday, January 17th, 2011, and this is your host, Chris Martinson. I'll now introduce a man who needs no introduction, Jim Rogers. Jim is a renowned author, financial commentator, Guinness World Record holder, and successful international investor. He lives in Singapore with his wife and two young daughters, for whom he wrote the recent bestseller, A Gift to My Children, A Father's Lessons for Life and Investing. It's an incredible book. Welcome, Jim. We're delighted to speak with you.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Chris.
Oh, our pleasure. You know, I'm worried that some people in the U.S. are beginning to tune out on inflation, the subject of inflation, believing the official story that is both contained and falling. But I think that's an insular point of view. I want your reaction to these six data points. So in Vietnam, inflation is now at a 22-month high, 11.75%. China's experiencing 5.1% inflation, raising reserve ratios. South Korea just hiked rates. India just hit 8.4% inflation, a rate hike there looms. And Thailand just hiked rates and are trying price controls. Sounds like the world's lit on fire, at least you're part of it, plus India. What's going on?
Yes, there's inflation throughout the world. You could have listed other countries as well. Norway, nearly everybody acknowledges that there's inflation. The U.S. doesn't, the U.K. doesn't, but most people know that there's inflation in the world. The U.S. lies about it. It's going to get worse. We have shortages of most commodities developing, plus the Federal Reserve in the U.S. is throwing gasoline on the fire by printing money. So it's going to be a real mess before it's over.
So inflation is really out of the bag, though. Why is it that the U.S. seems to be experiencing what they claim to be as no inflation? What's going on there?
Well, Chris, if you shop in the U.S., you know that there's inflation. Whether it's taxes or tolls or insurance or education or entertainment or food, I mean, the price of everything is going up. It's only in the U.S. government that says prices aren't going up. I guess CNBC says it too, but shop. I implore you, go down and try to buy something. You'll see that there is inflation in the U.S. just as there is everywhere else. I mean, Chris, people in America pay the same for cotton or rubber or tin or oil as everybody else in the world. So when they say that there's no inflation, I mean, I don't know how there possibly could be no inflation because prices of everything, nearly everything, are going up.
Well, certainly, if we look at a chart of commodities going back from about 2002, there was a little spike in 08, which sort of rippled there. But otherwise, you can draw a line with a ruler from 2002 to now. It's almost 10 years where we've been in close to double-digit commodity inflation. It's been a very impressive run there. So one way to look at this then is that the U.S. is actually exporting this inflation and expecting the rest of the world to shoulder that pain. Either the rest of the world accepts higher inflation or they have to accept a stronger currency to fight it, either of which is really a form of paying for past and current U.S. monetary and fiscal excesses. As a student of history, are there any parallels to tell us what happens next in this story?
Well, what happens next is that the rate of inflation continues to grow. Eventually, even the U.S. and the U.K. will have to acknowledge it. You will see more and more price increases make it through to the public. It will lead to higher interest rates. It will lead to a lower standard of living of all of us, except the ones, of course, who have figured out what's going on and can invest to protect themselves. But no, this is going to get worse. It's happened many, many times. There's nothing unusual about it. I'm not a very smart guy. I just looked it up. You know, your listeners can look it up, too. It's very simple the way this works out. Throughout history, when it started happening, eventually politicians and economists started saying, oh, well, don't worry, it's a one-shot thing. It's just because of a bad harvest or a bad this or a bad that. And don't worry, it won't last. But, of course, since they either don't realize what's going on or because they're lying about what's going on, it gets worse before anybody tries to do something to solve the problem.
Well, they're really playing with fire on this. I mean, history suggests that inflation has a bad habit of getting out of control before it can be brought back under control. So I see the U.S. exporting this inflation. Tell me, how is Asia managing this at this point, and what sort of reactions can they actually pull forward to make their own situation better?
Well, Asian countries are trying to do something about it. They know that there's inflation. The Chinese have raised interest rates twice. They've raised reserve requirements six times. I mean, people in Asia know what's going on. The governments haven't learned to lie about it yet, I guess, is the real answer to your question. Yeah. But they're trying to do something. South Koreans raised interest rates. Everybody's trying to do something about it. The Indians, it's here, and they know it.
Well, so, but if China and India at all, if they raise their rates, they're trying to control the demand pull portion of inflation. But if the cost push is due to the fact that the United States dollar is being speculated with, it's weakening, you know, crude prices are set in NYMEX or in London. So there's not much that raising rates in China is going to do about the crude oil price, is there?
Well, it certainly can reduce demand.
Mm-hmm.
Pricing comes from two things, supply and demand. And so if you reduce demand, it helps. The only way you're going to take care of supply is to increase supply. But, you know, that hasn't happened yet. And some people are trying to encourage, you know, increased production, but you can't just snap your fingers and open a new zinc mine. It takes 10 years to open a mine.
Well, so we can control, China and other countries can control a little bit of the demand side. But if the United States is creating a cost push through, well, there's, you know, supply and demand at the heart of it all. But again, it looks like the money situation is what's really driving the train to some extent. There's a lot of people who would prefer not to hold paper dollars right now. They'd rather hold things.
Yes, that's demand. You call it cost push. No, it's demand. Prices go up because of supply and demand. That leads to inflation. You can call it cost push inflation or whatever you want, but the costs are going higher because demand is increasing the price of cotton, of sugar, of tin, of cocoa, of everything else. If you cut demand, eventually you can cut the price increases, but you have to cut demand a lot, especially when supply is going down. You know, you can have demand going down and still have price increases if you have supply going down faster than demand. And in many commodities right now, you do have supply going down. So you're really going to have to cut demand a lot in order to kill inflation.
Well,
when Paul Volcker came into the Fed in 1979, he had to hit us with an axe, with a hammer, in order to cut demand and cut inflation. But he did so. So far, some countries are starting to try to cut the demand. The U.S. is not. The U.K. is not. Japan is not. But other major countries around the world are trying to cut demand.
Mm-hmm. So you've touched on another portion of this story for me, which is that there are indications now that certain minerals, sources of energy, some fertilizers, maybe raw land and crops, to name a few things, are not in sufficient supply right now to meet projected demand over the next years and coming decades. And some of these are kind of unique in human history, potentially. Tell us your views about resource scarcity and how you think this might shape our lives going forward.
Well, I've explained, we have shortages of things, everything developing. No, there's been only one lead mine opened in the world in 25 years. The last lead smelter built in the U.S. was built in 1969. No major elephant oil field discovered anywhere in the world in over 40 years. So supply of everything is going down, and that's going to continue until prices go high enough to encourage new productive capacity. But as I said, it takes 10 years to open up a mine these days on average around the world. Somebody's going to have to spend a lot of money to find new supplies of oil. Somebody's going to have to spend lots of money and time to build new nuclear power plants or solar plants or whatever. This all takes time, money, which you can't just snap your fingers and change the world.
Mm-hmm. And any concern that the stories about peak oil, the International Energy Agency came out and said, oops, looks like we're past peak conventional oil. We're going to have to make up the difference with all these exotic forms, non-conventional, they call them. Is that on your radar screen at all?
Well, I don't know if it's peak oil or not, but I know the known reserves of oil have peaked. Maybe there's a lot of oil out there somewhere, Chris, but we don't know where it is, if it's there, and it may be extremely expensive to get it. So, yes, the known reserves of oil are in decline. Mm-hmm. The IEA has been very vocal about that, pleading with governments to listen. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. And so in the meantime, you know, the prize is going to be how high the price of energy stays and how high it ultimately goes.
So, you know, a lot of people, myself included, are in kind of wait-and-see mode, wondering if or when the rest of the world will stop buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Is that a concern to you at all? Or, I mean, can the U.S. continually fund its fiscal deficits as far as the eye can see? Or do you see any sort of a event that might stop that?
Well, I'm short U.S. Treasury bonds, so it's my view that we're already going to have people cut back. I mean, U.S. is the largest debtor in the history of the world, and I'm not the only person who knows that. And the debts are getting bigger, not worse. And Bernanke is printing a lot of money. So you combine money printing with big debt issuance. Normally, people say, I don't want to lend you money for 30 years. Not in that kind of environment. So I've sold the bond short. That does not mean interest rates will continue going higher, but it might.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly the Federal Reserve's trying very hard to keep interest rates down. It's kind of an interesting program they've got going on there. I've been fairly critical that I don't believe we can print our way to prosperity. Several people disagree. So I think we can, I'm glad to hear that, thank you for telling us that you're short there. It's important to know. So you have a front row seat on the rise of the Asian economy from your home in Singapore then. If or when U.S. defaults on its debt obligation somewhere, either through devaluation of the currency or pure default, what specific steps do you see China, Japan, the rest of Asia taking to protect their interests?
Well, if the U.S. defaults on its obligations, which it may well someday, China's got a whole lot more on their plate than just trying to protect their interests, because by then the world is in pretty serious turmoil, currency turmoil, economic turmoil, and I presume that those governments will start public works projects in order to try to pick things up. Because, you know, if the U.S. dollar collapses, which it probably will someday, it makes the U.S. more competitive, but you have to have something to sell. You can only sell so much on price, and it will take a while. Conceivably, other countries will then become protectionist. We already see protectionism rising. And if that happens, of course, then it's all over. If you have serious turmoil in the currency markets and the rise of protectionism, then that's called serious, serious economic collapse. And economic collapse, of course, usually has led to war in the past. So it wouldn't be a pretty picture if and when the U.S. defaults.
Well, it'd be a fairly rare event. Obviously, it's historically not a very common thing, but the pressures are certainly building. And I think of default in two forms. There's a hard default, of course, like if they don't raise the debt ceiling in time or something silly. But the more likely default is a soft default through inflation and printing, which is the path we're currently on. And that's a knife edge, a really tricky knife edge to walk and get that story exactly right.
By the way, default is not such a rare event. I mean, we've had, you know, probably, I think the average is there's been a country defaulting every year for the past century or two. So not the U.S. obviously hasn't, but other people, default is not so uncommon even by nation.
Yeah, well, I don't think we've had one where the reserve currency countries defaulted, but it's certainly a possibility at this point.
The U.K. could not sell bonds back in the 1970s. Of course, it had begun to lose its status as the world's reserve currency by then. So I guess technically you're correct.
We've been hearing from other commentators located outside the U.S., like Mark Faber, that the longstanding U.S. view is that the rest of the world needs us more than we need them, that view is becoming obsolete. For instance, China's economy has surpassed America's now in terms of purchasing power parity or in the production of real things. Do you see these same trends and the same hubris as you look inside the U.S. from outside?
Well, no, it's very clear that the U.S. does need, I mean, we all need each other. So the idea that one needs, that the world needs the U.S. more or the U.S. needs the world more, I mean, we all need each other. The U.S. is the largest economy in the world. And if it collapses, it's going to affect everybody. Mm-hmm. Likewise, if other economies collapse, it's going to hurt the U.S. We're all in this together. Now, the U.S. is not as dominant and powerful as it was maybe 50 years ago, but, I mean, this is 2011. It's not 1961. And more people are understanding that the U.S. is overextended militarily, geopolitically, economically, financially. And you don't have to be a genius. All you have to do is look to your left and look to your right, or look straight ahead, and you'll see the U.S. is very overextended.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So what do you think the U.S. could, should be doing to regain its competitiveness in this new century?
Well, the U.S. has to change its tax code dramatically. We in the U.S. tax savings and investing. Other countries don't. We need to tax consumption instead of saving and investing. We need to dramatically change the whole litigation scene, which affects education, affects health care, affects everything. And we have to slash spending. We have to, not with an axe, with a chainsaw, because as long as we continue to run up these gigantic debts, our standard of living is going to continue to decline. Mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot borrow to prosperity. Maybe for a while you can, but eventually the standard of living is going to continue to decline because more and more of your effort is spent paying off previous debts. There have been studies which show that once you get up to 90% of debt to gross national product, you really don't, it's very difficult to grow at all because, you know, everything you do goes to pay off the past. Well, America's at that stage. Our standard of living has been declining because we're all running just to stay in place. People who are deep in debt know that, you know. Your credit card debt's too high or your student loans or whatever. Everything you make just goes to pay off the debt instead of to improve your standard of living.
Mm-hmm. So, and you believe so strongly in this grand theme of shift that you moved your family from New York to Asia and advise that one of the greatest gifts we can give our children is to teach them Mandarin, as you're apparently doing with your own daughters.
We moved to Asia because for our daughters, I want my daughters to grow up speaking Mandarin and knowing Asia, because I'm of the view that 21st century Asia will be much more important than it has in the past. The only way to do that is to move to Asia. We moved to Singapore, as you probably know. Many parents do all sorts of things for their children. People mm-hmm. move their kids to other schools so they can play football or whatever. We moved to Asia so that our kids get an education in Mandarin and get a very strict, rigorous, demanding education. You know, Asian education is better than U.S. education. So we moved here to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely true. The U.S. competitiveness in that sphere, there's a lot of room for introspection on education, certainly in this country. Okay, I want to turn to the future now a little bit. What are the big themes you see for 2011? What are you watching most closely?
Discussed it. More inflation and more currency turmoil as we go forward. The huge debt imbalances in the world. The U.S. is the largest debtor nation in the world. And all the assets are in Asia, the largest creditors in the world are China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore. This is where the assets are, and the debts are in the West. That's got to be, those imbalances have to be resolved. They frequently lead to more currency turmoil. We'll see more inflation. We'll see more governments fall. We just saw Tunisia fall. More are coming because the world's going to continue to have these problems and especially inflation, is going to cause more social unrest.
All right, so we have inflation, more currency turmoil. There's assets in the East, debts in the West. This is a fairly, you're painting a fairly fundamental structural picture of that's going to take a while to resolve, obviously, under the best of circumstances. My question then is, so imagine for a moment that you're in the West somewhere and you're not an exceptionally wealthy person. Maybe you couldn't move out of the West to the East. What specific steps would you advise for somebody to think about financially, physically, emotionally? What would someone do in that circumstance?
Well, I'd try to make sure my kids and grandkids get good education, but I'd also learn about investing in real assets, whether it's rice or silver or natural gas. That's the only way to protect yourself when currencies are being debased. And I would also learn about investing abroad, whatever your country, whether you live in England or whoever. Everybody should learn about investing abroad as insurance policies.
You know, one of the things I work very hard to do is try and educate people on exactly this, understanding what the big sweeping changes are. And I think everybody owes it to themselves to know what the Fed is up to and watch it very carefully and watch what the fiscal guys are up to. Because, you know, once upon a time you could work and ignore that stuff. But these days it seems you have to really also put those things on your plate and pay very close attention to them. So rice, sugar, silver, farmland, agricultural commodities. Does history suggest that this is where you want to be always when you get into an inflationary regime?
Well, don't invest in anything unless you know what you're doing. If you don't know anything about silver, don't think about investing in sugar. But if you know about sugar or other assets, you might consider trying to invest in it.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. Now, I want to thank you so much for your time and giving us so much to ponder. So good luck in 2011, and may 60% of your trades be winners.
Thank you very much.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.